After murdering a former coworker, he was tracked down at a cheap motel and put on death row, where detectives suddenly got around to asking him about a whole slew of other suspicious deaths he might have been involved in. Had he been protected as an FBI informant? This is the true crime story of Johnny Martini, the New Jersey kidnapper and serial killer my friend actually knew. Hi friends, I'm Katie, and this is Katie Does Crime. Thank you for joining me for the first time if you're new here, and hello to the usual scoundrels and rapscallions. Please consider subscribing or joining me on Patreon if you'd like to hear more true crime stories. I was out to dinner the other night in Manhattan with a couple of friends when one of them said, "Have I ever told you about my Uncle Johnny, the serial killer?" I wasn't sure if he meant uncle or uncle in the way that Italians mean it, but lo and behold, Uncle Johnny Martini is my friend's uncle's brother-in-law, so still certainly related. He said the thing he remembers most about the family is that Johnny's daughter had the coolest room growing up, with a pinball machine and a soda machine. Aside from, you know, the serial killing, sounds like Uncle Johnny must have been a pretty cool dad. John Johnny Martini Sr. was born on July 30th, 1930. He married his teenage sweetheart, Alice Drew, around 1950, and they went on to have three girls and a boy. Johnny and Alice moved to Arizona in the 1970s. When we catch up with Martini in November 1988, the 58-year-old had divorced his wife of 39 years to be with his 29-year-old girlfriend. He lived in New Jersey for ages before spending some time in Arizona, but now he was back east, this time in New York City. Here in NYC, he and his girlfriend met up with a friend named Victor Picardi. Johnny Martini claimed that he'd lost his wallet and asked to borrow Mr. Picardi's credit card. And Mr. Picardi handed it over because I guess that's what friends did in 1988. Johnny then took his girlfriend back to New Jersey, where they rented an apartment in the town of Fairview, right across the water from Manhattan. The name they put on the lease was Picardi. Now settled in New Jersey, Johnny met up with another old friend and complained about his lack of money. The friend loaned him $6,000, but said what he should really do to make a quick buck was kidnap 58-year-old Irving Flax, a local warehouse manager and acquaintance of the two. He and Johnny had both been truck drivers for the same company way back when. This friend had been working at Irving Flax's house recently and couldn't help but notice the cash and bank books lying around. One of the bank books showed that Mr. Flax had upwards of $100,000 in an account. And this guy just happened to know that Flax left for work every morning between 9:30 and 10. They made a plan to split the haul. The friend provided the directions for the Flax home, a .32-caliber revolver, and fake driver's licenses for Johnny and his girlfriend. Johnny then bought another .32-caliber revolver because you can never have too many. So on January 23, 1989, Johnny and his girlfriend drove to Mr. Flax's house and parked their blue Buick so they could see anyone coming and going. When Mr. Flax walked outside at 9:30 a.m., Johnny strolled up to him, called him by a nickname from their younger days, and asked if the two could grab a coffee. Mr. Flax recognized Johnny enough to say, sure, he'd drive them to a diner. But once in the car, Johnny pulled out his new revolver and let Mr. Flax know he was being kidnapped. Under duress, he drove the two to the Garden State Plaza Mall parking lot in Paramus, New Jersey, where Johnny's girlfriend brought his car. Johnny made Mr. Flax get into his car and then drove them all to the apartment Johnny had rented under the fake name. At 10 a.m., they had Mr. Flax call his wife, tell her she needed to stay home, and say that he'd call back in 15 or 20 minutes. He told her everything was fine. Then Johnny and his girlfriend taped his ankles together and bound his wrists with tape and an extension cord. When Mrs. Flax's phone rang 30 minutes later, this time it was Johnny, saying freedom would cost $100,000. He told her not to involve the police, or both Flaxes would end up dead. Then Mr. Flax called and instructed her to hand over the money and not to call the police. But Mrs. Flax was no shrinking flower and immediately called the cops. Before they had a chance to tap her phone, Johnny called again, calling himself Tony, and asked if she'd gotten a hold of his requested ransom. He threatened her life repeatedly, but he also kindly said that it was fine if she could at least get $25,000 for him. The phone taps were installed, the FBI arrived, and Mrs. Flax went to get $25,000 in cash from the bank. FBI agents took down the serial numbers of the bills and packaged up the money in a brown paper bag. When Johnny called back at 5:30 p.m., he told Mrs. Flax to drive to the Forum Diner in Paramus and meet him out back at 7:30. He said he'd wave his hands, she'd open the car door and throw the money down, and her husband would call her when she got home, both of them safe and sound. He threatened that if someone ever came after him, someone else will come, maybe in 2 days, to kill the two of yas. I like that the court documents write the ya and only wish it was yous instead to make it seem more Jersey. Mr. Flax called a moment later, screaming and crying, and told her to give them what they wanted. Johnny left Mr. Flax at the apartment, went to pick up his car at the parking lot where they left it earlier, and drove to the diner. At the same time, Mrs. Flax was donning a bulletproof vest and hiding an FBI agent in her car for protection. At the back of the diner, Johnny waved his hands in the air. Mrs. Flax threw the ransom money onto the ground and drove away, and undercover FBI agents followed Johnny as he collected the money and drove off. He stopped at a Days Inn along the way because he thought the money had bugs in it. Not like FBI listening devices, but actual bugs. Apparently, he was hallucinating them. He then drove into the Bronx to make sure he wasn't being followed. He hoped he might be able to shake anyone who might be watching him in the dense Bronx traffic, and it worked. The agents lost him. At around 9 p.m., Johnny and his girlfriend drove Mr. Flax back to the parking lot, and Johnny claims that Mr. Flax opened his door and started to get out. And worrying that he was about to lose his kidnappee, Johnny shot him in the back of the head 3 times. But the money had already been paid. Who cares if the guy escapes, right? Johnny and his girlfriend left Mr. Flax in his car, took the keys, and went back to their apartment to do some coke. Then they took the Staten Island ferry to get rid of the gun and the stolen keys in the bay below Manhattan, although Johnny sort of forgot the purpose of the ferry ride when he got to the top deck, and he stopped to buy a couple of hot dogs from the vendor up there. He ate one of the hot dogs before being like, oh, right, the murder. So he tried to throw the gun into the bay, but got confused and threw the hot dog instead. He couldn't understand why it didn't sink. Eventually realizing his mistake, he got rid of the gun and keys. The next day, a security guard saw a car in a secluded corner of the mall parking lot and went to check if anything suspicious was going on. He found Mr. Flack still decked out in a gold chain, wrist chain, watch, and wedding ring, blood spatter everywhere. Incredibly, that very day, the local police received word that a Mr. John Martini and his girlfriend could be on the run back in his hometown area after committing a double homicide where they'd been living in Arizona. The cops started combing local motels and saw Johnny and his girlfriend leave the Fort Lee Days Inn and head for a phone booth with a black bag. The police nabbed them just as they were about to get into a waiting cab. Inside the black bag was over $23,000 with the recorded serial numbers, Victor Picardi's credit card, the fake driver's licenses, and a fully loaded revolver. At the trial, a forensic expert testified that because of the blood spatter on the windows and the way Mr. Flax's wounds looked, there's no way he was trying to escape the car at the time he was shot. Instead, it appeared that Johnny had been directly behind him in the rear passenger seat, the door had been closed, and the shots were fired at close range. There was also Mr. Flax's blood on Johnny's pants, and an acquaintance of Johnny's was able to identify his voice on one of the FBI wiretap tapes. Johnny's defense was that he was addicted to cocaine, and it was all his girlfriend's fault. She was a 19-year-old prostitute and drug addict when he met her, and she'd gotten him into his $500-a-day coke habit. His former wife testified that when Johnny started cheating on her with this girlfriend, the drugs had made him a completely changed person, violent and unpredictable. She said he'd overdosed twice during their marriage. A psychiatrist testified that not only did Johnny have a serious drug problem, but he tested high for paranoia and schizophrenia, which explains why he thought there were bugs in the money and why he thought Mr. Flax was running away from the car. Oh, right, and why he threw a hot dog off the side of the Staten Island ferry, thinking it was a gun. Clear mental deficiencies aside, the jury found Johnny guilty on all counts, and he was sentenced to death in December 1990. While he was still on death row in 1995, Johnny couldn't stand the bad prison food and horrible living conditions and asked to be put to death right then and there. But then he chickened out, and his sentence was later commuted to life in prison when New Jersey abolished the death penalty in 2007. Mrs. Flax wrote him a letter after this and said, "God created heaven and hell for a select few, and I know that when you die, that's where you will be going, and I know your soul will be tormented forever and ever." She was glad to be able to get in the last word. Johnny died on September 10th, 2009, at age 79, while in prison. The thing is, the Flax murder isn't Johnny Martini's only indiscretion. While he was hanging out on death row, detectives grilled him about some other cases that suddenly seemed especially suspicious. The death of his aunt and uncle in Atlantic City. A woman shot in Philadelphia. A cousin who was found in the trunk of his own car with a bullet to the head in Phoenix. His former son-in-law who was found shot in his own car in New Jersey. And two friends who died in Glendale, Arizona. Johnny's aunt and uncle were found stabbed in their apartment in Atlantic City, and he was questioned because he stood to collect $175,000 as the benefactor of her estate. The case remains unsolved. He pleaded guilty to the Glendale, Arizona murders, saying that he did kill Teresa Marie Dempster, a 27-year-old suspected drug dealer, and her friend 42-year-old salesman David Richard All, when they were all living in Arizona. Johnny was paranoid that his drug supplier was trying to kill him and went for her first. She and her friend were found dead in a car in a mall parking lot, just like Irving Flax. As for the Philadelphia case, a jury said he was guilty of shooting a 62-year-old woman he was doing business with. Her name was Anna Mary Duval, but she went by Polly. She was a friend of one of Johnny's sisters, and she had flown from Phoenix to Philly to work out a real estate deal with him in October 1977. He owed her $35,000 and didn't want to pay it. So Johnny picked her up from the airport, shot her in the head several times, and disposed of her naked body near the airport. An interesting thing about this case was that this woman's body was so damaged and decomposed that the medical examiner thought she might never be identified. But a sculptor came through the morgue one day for an anatomy studies class, and he was able to imagine with his artist's eye what her face would have looked like. The sculptor made a fiberglass bust, a picture of it was taken, and a flyer was made to see if anyone might recognize her. A local policeman recognized the woman on the flyer as the woman from a missing persons report, and Anna Duval's case went on to be solved. Johnny also managed to bribe a jail guard in 1989 to bring him diamond cutting wire, which he used as a saw on the law library's window bars. He and another inmate planned to escape and kidnap the guard's kid for more ransom money. The other inmate only turned him in when it was revealed that part of the escape plan involved killing one of the guards. Johnny also, and this won't surprise you at all, threatened his own lawyer in one of his cases to the point that the court had to appoint him a new one. The New York Times reports that Johnny was also an FBI informant starting as early as the 1960s, when he was convicted of stealing a load of women's underwear. He worked as a truck driver and began to give the government information about trucks or goods the mob had stolen. The FBI stopped using him in 1986 because he made up a story about mafia money laundering, and they felt that they could no longer trust him. But knowing that Johnny was an informant for so long maybe explains why four of his relatives went missing between 1981 and 1987, and he was never charged. He requested to join witness protection after his arrest for the murder of Irving Flax, but the FBI rejected him. The more I read about Johnny Martini, the more I can't believe I'd never heard of him before. He's one of those people who just seemed to do what he wanted, no remorse, no consideration for anyone but himself. The assistant DA who prosecuted the Philadelphia murder case said, "This was one of the nastiest killers around. If he can help himself by lying, he'll lie. If he can help himself by killing, he'll kill." Thank you for tuning into my podcast episode. I'm just a true crime fan like you are, and I really appreciate you taking a chance on me. Please subscribe and tell a friend if you like spending this time together. You can also find me on YouTube in the flesh by searching Katie Does Crime.